Clean jokes.
All right.
These are real clean.
All right, we'll call to order this March 4th, 2014 meeting of the Committee for Citizen Involvement. This evening, we're going to be discussing, the council has asked us to review this concept about pay and revising the charter to allow for pay for the councilors and mayor. So Neil Ladati is going to talk with us this evening, and I see Mary Bridget is here as well. So
to make sure what I'm saying is
that's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Keep you in line.
Will that take a vote?
Will that take
changing
a vote?
The charter, will that take a vote of the people?
Yes.
Okay. So thank you for having me here and for taking up this discussion. So I think what we'll do is I'll give you some brief background of what has kind of got us to this point, and then open up for discussion. So a brief presentation and then some discussion. So as you know, the Springfield councilors have never been compensated. It's in the charter from the 1800s that they would not be compensated. We do give them reimbursements for mileage. We give them reimbursement for gas, we give them reimbursement for their internet, for a portion of their internet, since we've gone to the paperless packets, which saved the city about $10,000 a year, but we do give them a stipend. Since 1885, though, when the charter was first put down, the job has changed quite a bit from those first counselors. And what we see now is a 25 to 35 hours a week that we expect from the counselors, and you, as the Planning Commission, with your other hat, know very well how large those packets are that we expect them to be able to speak on and vote on. They also have a full day, typically, of meetings. There's not just their council meeting, but they're doing the wastewater meetings, the transportation meetings, rail meetings, meetings throughout the week that have a direct impact on the citizens of the community. They often, to go to these meetings, especially if they're working, they take vacation time to go to these meetings. Mayor Lundberg was probably one of the worst offenders of taking and using all of her vacation time to do things like ribbon cuttings and transportation meetings, and then being, when she was at Marshall's, out of vacation time. The counselors are also expected to go to events over the weekend and represent the community. Often, if they want to bring a spouse or someone, they're not, the city does not pay for that. We do not reimburse them. The counselors pay for that. So several months ago, a few counselors got together, led by former counselor Joe Piccinieri. Those counselors were, along with Joe, Hillary Wiley and Councilor Mary Lee Woodrow. When Joe left the council, Councilor Sherry Moore took his spot on this committee. And they discussed these issues moving forward. And the two big things that came out of it are, one, and there's some debate on whether this is true, but they think some sort of stipend might open the pool of people that can run for a council. Some people say that it doesn't have an impact, especially at the low amount they've been talking about, but that was one of the main talking points that came out of that. Mary Lee, for example, things that you don't even think of when she goes to some meetings in Salem, or if we send her to Portland, she needs to find and pay for care for her pets, and we don't reimburse that either. So it was things like that that we had never really thought of that may close the door to someone who wants to be a counselor. But the main thing, the main point that came out of it was it shouldn't cost counselors money to be on the council. And that's, for many of them, what was happening. So again, this was not a staff-driven idea, it was a council idea. And when this was presented to council in February, the counselors looked at this information. They looked, and if you have your attachment one, there is an outline of what some of the other cities do that are similar in size to Springfield. Eugene, for example, is quite larger than Springfield. However, the Springfield counselors are expected to go to all the same meetings that the City of Eugene counselors do. The City of Eugene is also an outlier in that they are paid much more than any other city for their counselors. Mayors are often paid if they're a working mayor, but the counselors are typically not paid that much. So they reviewed this, and while they support the idea of some sort of compensation and the $300 a month idea is what came up, $500 for the mayor, they weren't comfortable making that decision to put it on the ballot, and so they decided to give it to a community group, and the Committee for Citizen Involvement seemed like a likely place. So with that background, there are some options, and again, the council didn't decide any options, but what they're hoping to get from this committee is either a motion to kind of approve moving forward with the November ballot measure to change the charter. Two, make a recommendation for denial and say, you know, we don't think this is a good idea and move that back to the council. Or three, come up with some sort of their next citizen committee that might have a broader reach and let that committee review it. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. I know you guys aren't shy when it comes to discussing these type of topics.
Okay, so Neil, looking at the agenda summary, what I see here is send the issue to the Planning Commission to coordinate the review of this proposal by other city officials appointed to Springfield's various boards, committees, and commissions.
It was an idea that came out. There was no concrete ideas.
So really, I was not at the council, city council work session or hearing.
Yeah, my feeling was a couple thought it would be good to get a citizen group involved. The rest thought it's just like starting all over if we've already got a citizens group, which is a CCI. And we got the hearing ready for us to work. If we come up with an idea, say yes, let's go forward, let's set it up, have a public hearing, notify everyone in plenty of time, we can handle it just as easy as getting a whole nother group of citizens involved. That was the consensus.
So we're not coordinating the review, we are the review.
That was my feeling that they
different
said,
different than the wording.
Why mm-hmm. start all over with a whole mm-hmm. nother group, a mm-hmm. citizens group? It's gonna take drawn out. Mm-hmm. We've got that citizens group right here with the Planning Commission.
Well, let me tell you something that, you know, I know about elections too. I know that the city council goes into their summer recess when? In
June?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And also, if this was to be placed on a November ballot, it would need to be, what, to the county by September?
At the latest.
At the latest,
yeah.
I think, yeah. I thought it was sometime in August that would have been.
I think it's
there.
August, the end of August.
Okay. So what that says is, you know, if there's going to be November action, we'll have to make a recommendation will need to be made back to council in time for them to make a decision before their recess. Would that?
I think so. It's a good
would
point.
That be
correct?
Correct.
Yes. And let me clarify quickly. I did not write this very well. That paragraph. It is the council was sending it to the Planning Commission at the time, but to the Committee for Citizen Involvement to decide if you wanted to send it to another group or if you wanted to make a decision. I did not write that very clear, but that was the initial intent.
Okay. So the question, one of the questions we have is how do we feel we want to handle this? Do we feel it's important to vet this a little bit further? Or do we feel, you know, and there are lots of ways that we could do that with, you know, appointing a blue ribbon group that might be made up of, you know, chamber and other folks and, you know, one or two of us serving on that group as well. or do we feel we could have that discussion and make a recommendation?
Part of what would help me to make that decision is has there been wording that the council worked on that they would change the charter to, that people would see on the ballot? I mean, you know, there's unanswered questions for me, such as how would increases be handled? Is this charter going to be changed? I'm certain it's not going to be changed to these amounts, but it's going to be changed to something broader. So some of that wording makes a difference to me whether it needs to be a bigger process or not.
So the council didn't arrive at any particular language. They had some discussion about different ways, and we talked about how different jurisdictions have handled it.
Mm-hmm.
Some jurisdictions do have a specific amount in their charter. Some run any increases through their budget process and budget committee. Some change every year, Eugene changes every year depending on a CPI.
Mm-hmm.
A lot run through either their council procedures. They might have somebody look at increasing it depending on, if they don't run it through their budget, they might approve it as part of their council procedures.
Mm-hmm.
The budget is a way to kind of have a check on it without having the council raising
mm-hmm.
its own amount.
Are they wanting
so we had
us?
A general conversation about that, but no specific
yeah.
language and no specific change in the charter language, because
uh-huh.
really all the charter says is there's no compensation.
Uh-huh. So are they wanting us to come up with that language, or are they just wanting our blessing and then they're going to come up with that language?
That's a good question. I don't know if they ever got to that kind of detail in the work session about how that part of it would work. Unless you remember differently.
There was nothing specific.
Yeah, I happen to have an opinion about that.
Uh-huh.
I think, personally, what they've done, and I talked with the mayor about this as well, you know, they, because this is for their own benefit, they really want input from an outside group to
right.
come back and
yeah.
say, you know, this is what we would recommend that you do. And I think... You know, I think we need to, as citizens, we all interact with our neighbors and our friends and folks around the city, and so I think it would be, I think it's incumbent upon us if there's some, you know, if we feel strongly about something, like, you know, I personally don't feel it should be tied to CPI. I think there needs to be. I feel the citizens of Springfield, I think it's going to be a tough sell, to be quite honest with you. I mean, the city of Eugene is pretty liberal, and they just barely squeaked theirs through in 2001, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Although our council is not asking for a great deal. The
mm-hmm.
city of Eugene,
yeah.
it was quite a stretch.
It was less than they get now.
Yeah,
through.
But you know, but I think it would be difficult for this electorate to without any controls, just to say, yeah, let's change the charter to say that they can pay themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't personally think that would pass muster with the citizens. And I'm sure the council would have some input into
mm-hmm.
that as well. Yes, Stacy, and then Tim.
What kind of impact is this going to have on the city? Is this going to be a large impact, or is this something that the city thinks that, you know,
it's
is
about
doable?
$27,000 a year.
So how does that compare
total.
About the reimbursements that currently happen?
And those won't go away.
Plus
no,
that.
But I mean, oh, okay, so it's going to be
on top
of
that. But
they
won't go away, but that's
a
good question, isn't it? Like, $5,000 a year or something?
That's what,
is
it
currently
is
what
now.
The reimbursements come to.
And that's going to be
per
in addition?
No.
Total.
Yeah.
So are the continued reimbursements for gas and things like that also going to be on top of this other? And the city is, how does staff feel about that? Or what do they feel about this whole idea?
Staff's neutral on the idea.
Okay.
They have to be.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking budget impact.
It's not a huge impact.
That.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's kind of what I'm trying to.
Well, that's where budget, you know, that's where somebody on the budget committee might have a strong feeling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
sure,
if it has
you know.
To go and be voted on, I think there needs to be some kind of a, you know, discussion, a hearing, getting the public a little bit more involved in this discussion, not just having us discuss it and then deciding to take it to the council.
Yeah, they're definitely, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tim.
I was gonna say, who is proposed to do the hearing? Is it the council, or is it us, or is it to be determined?
I think it would be.
Well, they have handed this now to the planning commission.
But I mean, there's some point where, you know, we're talking about public input, there has to be a point where that occurs.
It would be this group, and this group seems like a, makes sense, because you're the committee for citizen involvement. If there was some sort of, you know, blue ribbon panel or citizen group, you know, that might be a hard way to get a lot of public hearing, public input, because you're just gonna have these people who are on the committee.
Well, and then it's all of a sudden gonna be on the ballot, and people are gonna be like, I never even heard about this. So it seems like the information needs to get out.
So there are lots of ways you can gather information.
Sure.
You could do a survey on a website, you could do, what's the one, the Survey Monkey, you know? The city probably has a huge list of involved citizens, emails and those types of things that you could do a Survey Monkey to. And, you know, we could frame that, you know, do you think this is a good idea? Do you think there should be some limits? If there are some limits involved, what would they be, you know, A, B, or C? Are these amounts about correct? Go ahead.
Johnny was first, and then I'll.
Okay.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I believe that's what the council intention was, is to have us kind of handle it.
Draft that.
And draft the whole thing, have a public hearing, get the information out to all the citizens, and I agree, start out with just a little monkey,
Survey
Monkey. Get that going, so at least you got it out there, and it's been in the Register Guard now. Everyone seems to read the Register Guard. But it's gonna be out there, and we've got till November, but I.
No, we have till.
August, I mean, August, November's the vote.
But they go on recess in when?
Right.
June, we have until June, yeah.
So we'd have to get it in by the end of July 1st.
Yeah, that's not much time.
So, 3.5 months.
That's why it would be next year if we got, I think, another group involved, and I just think that's a lot of extra that I don't think is necessary personally. And I don't think it's gonna be a hard sell at all.
Yeah.
27,000 to 90,000. And when you look at a little city like Bandon, Oregon with 3,100 people, they were $100 and $200 per councilor and mayor.
Well, but here's.
So I'm.
Go ahead.
Thanks. So I would almost like to have a joint meeting around this with the budget committee. That's one of my thoughts. Another is, there's not been any polling done, and I don't think there needs to be. Polling is expensive, but a Survey Monkey not only serves a couple purposes. One, it would give feedback in a kind of a public hearing way, because we would have those answers, but it also gets the word out. You know, if they're gonna have it on the ballot, Neil knows
the key
about this.
Yeah, sure.
you're gonna wanna start some of those things just to even get the word out.
Yeah.
And it's very inexpensive.
And from what I'm gathering, they really kind of want us to.
$20.
Yeah, it's cheap.
They really want us to come back with a recommendation or an A, B, C of the wording of, you know, how is that what you're thinking, is they want us not just a blessing, but come back with a recommendation on how this operates.
I think that would be helpful.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Tim.
Since you've mentioned that this has been discussed on a number of different occasions, have more cities other than what's listed here, it's a rather short list, other cities around the state that have been surveyed as far as what their compensation levels are, because there's quite a few cities that are.
The list I included is the list I did personally. There's plenty of lists about, you know, all the cities in Oregon, but some of them are so
Roseburg
old.
Is
the vast majority of cities that aren't mentioned here have compensation levels, or
I wouldn't say the vast majority.
I don't know if I'd say
the
vast majority, but many do. Oh, I think at least half.
Okay.
Yes,
right.
I think so.
That's good.
Within the same population range.
Yeah, there's a League of Oregon Cities survey. It's just that it's a little bit old, and so these are ones we've been able to pursue verify.
Can I ask a question? stipend to me is like an oxymoron when you say $43,000 a year annually. What is a stipend actually? What's the definition of stipend? I thought it was a smaller amount, but maybe I'm totally off. I always thought a stipend was a small amount. But when I saw a stipend for the mayor of Tigard, $43,000 a year plus benefits and all that, to me it just seems like...
It should be payroll, not stipend.
Yeah, yeah.
The Tigard mayor might be a strong mayor. I'm not sure about that. So that might be, I mean, I would think a stipend's being, that just, in that particular circumstance, being paid.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that was just... One thing I wanted to get. Yeah.
Stipends, well, usually you have to put on your tax return, and then you can deduct your expenses against it, but the net is actually subject to taxes and self-employment taxes, Medicare and Social Security. So.
Sounds more, yes. Nick.
Am I assuming that like all the mayor and all the council wanted this to go forward in terms of getting some type of funds?
I think they were all in favor of it going to this committee.
Okay.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it kind of seems like the amount's pretty nominal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they should, I mean, either pay them enough to get someone in there that's maybe going to be more dynamic or more impressive, I guess, or not pay at all. That's just me.
Seems low to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a, I wouldn't make a big impact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are there options on exactly how this is placed into the charter? I realize that the vote to process it, but the wording can be, I mean, as far as whether you're locking in a specific compensation level or whether you're locking this in or whether, because my personal opinion would be I prefer to see an option within the writing of this where it would be subject to periodic review, not only the compensation itself, but also the level of compensation. So every 3 years it's reviewed whether because of economic conditions the environment changes.
Like placing a quota with it or something, or...
We can do anything we want.
Or just review.
We can put anything we want in there.
I mean, I think we could probably...
Well, I mean, I can see where the option of simply locking in a statement of what we're doing to where it's inflexible or creating an option for a review. That,
well, yeah, sure. I think Mary Bridget gave a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. One being, you know, the flexibility, but put it in... someone like the budget committee's lap, right? Because those are appointed folks and they are serving in a process.
Well, 50%.
Yeah.
Because the council is also...
That's true.
Yeah.
So, or some other mechanism, you know, not to exceed CPI, but reviewed by the CCI and approved.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see that easily as being an issue for periodic review where we look at it and say, well, the economy or the budget, the fiscal environment has changed pro or con, and we can make adjustments.
Okay, so we've got about 5 minutes left. Let me recap what I've heard, and let me see if I can kind of get us to movement in a direction. It sounds to me as if we talked about a couple of things. I heard... Commissioner Bean, or talk about the budget committee and having a dialogue with the budget committee. Are those folks the budget committee? I mean, it's a year-round term, but they have started the budget process yet?
I know they appointed a couple members last night. But I don't know how much of the process they've actually started. But two boards were appointed last night.
Okay. So that was one concept. The other concept also was, or part of that was, doing some sort of a survey with folks that we know are interested and involved. And also, I think part of that is put something on the website just for Joe Citizen to be able to say, you know, we want your opinion on this issue, this topic. To do that, I think what we're going to need to do is identify maybe a couple of folks of our CCI group to work into, because, you know, we can't work in a group this size and craft kind of the questions to go into that type of a survey. I don't think that would be effective for us to do, but if we get a couple of us to work on that and commit to do that and bring it back to this group for approval before it went out, do you think that would be something we could do?
Yes, and Neil, you could actually help put the survey out, right? So
definitely.
It would be great for you to be part of the group.
Absolutely.
I would think. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do. We could do website, social media.
Yeah.
All of those outlets.
So I think, you know, we could start those processes, and then I think ultimately the outcome would be public notice and a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we've got to gather some information first.
I think that a survey, you wouldn't want to get too complex.
Oh, no.
Because,
no, because we're gonna
you're talking to the public in
yeah,
general.
Yeah, like I'm saying,
here's
you
the
know,
idea
maybe
that we're looking at.
Five or six questions, you know, maybe the threshold, you know, the amount, how it should be. Should it be limited at all or not? You know, just that you could probably break it down into five pretty straight questions that would give us a lot of guidance.
Do you want a second subcommittee to do some research? I mean, Neil started
language,
that process. Research for language, but and tie into Mary Bridget and the research that they've done already. I mean, I just am throwing that out there.
I've had a legal extern of mine do some research about different cities, about kind of charter language and that kind of thing, and we'd be happy to share that. Maybe if this group reconvened or somehow some more detailed information. I don't know if you might, maybe you'd want to, after you see that information, see if you still want to do a subcommittee. Because really, I think it kind of boils down to just like a few
okay.
options.
So
up to you, but I think I could get that to you.
So,
okay.
So Mary Bridget, if you could pull that together,
mm-hmm.
and I think part of the important, I've heard a couple of things stated.
Mm-hmm.
One is, what's the population of the city?
Okay.
I think that's an important piece for us to know. And then what are the limiting factors, or are there any limiting factors? Does it
okay.
tie back to the budget process? Is it tied to CPI? Is it automatic? Is it, you know,
right.
Okay.
is it locked in? You know, is the language really open that just says they can do this and it's
right.
set by another group at another level other than the city council
mm-hmm.
or... Yeah.
Okay, so if we're going to have a public hearing at some point, what time frame are we looking for? When do we need to have this posted by? How many days?
If the notice.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, they do the. I mean, I would just go by what you guys do in planning and land use, and generally that's 10. It's 20 days. Some
okay.
can be as short as 10.
Okay.
But you'd want to do 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Brenda
so.
Has reminded me that summer recess is July 29th.
Oh,
so
okay.
we have a little more
time.
Yeah.
Okay.
okay.
We always
right.
dream that it's going to happen.
All right. So, you know, if we have kind of our ducks in the row in a row, and we can have a public hearing in June even,
mm-hmm.
And then take information and report to the council at one of their July meetings, we'd be in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do you think? I mean, you would want to give them an opportunity to process a little bit, you know, probably work session and then, so.
So what I hear you saying, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, how easy would it be to pull up charter language from other cities as a format or a template?
No problem. Get that right.
Yeah.
So that we could use that
pointing to.
So what I hear you saying in terms of a recommendation is that the recommendation of this group would be, or sort of the head nod would be, to gather more information, I guess public input, more information about technically how the language would look or what the process would be, and then comparison of Springfield to other cities. And then eventually some kind of public hearing conducted by this group with notice to the general public to see what their input would be.
Yep.
So kind of two types of public input, more informal through the website or some kind
yep.
of survey,
yep.
and then a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. And then I think we would need to pull back together and kind of tie a bow with our findings
mm-hmm.
and present it to the council.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right? We'd need to wrap up about early July or thereabouts before
sure.
somewhere in that range.
Everybody feel comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
You're being awfully quiet over there.
Well, I tried to jump in a couple times, but everybody was pretty enthused, so I just stepped back and shut up. Anyway, I am disappointed that this issue comes up now, paying the counselors, because I'm too old to run for council.
You're never too old, Steve.
You consider counselors that how old?
You just got to move to this side of the river.
No, actually, I'm right on city limits right now.
Are you
finally
in city limits or on city limits?
Right next to it now.
Next to it, but it, you gotta go.
I don't think age is a very good excuse.
I already checked into annexation. It's quite a little process.
Yeah. You're fun.
Do you have strong feelings about this, Steve?
This? Well, I think it's an issue. The city's. I was thinking a little bit. You know, county commissioners used to be voluntary too. You know, then they elected to have five commissioners and pay them.
Yeah.
And they're busy all the time and catch all the hell. And the city, I just go away from that a little bit. I remember it was all businessmen. All businessmen were councilors when the elections came up. Yeah. Regular people weren't there. And that's gone. But I remember those days. And if you look at some old records, I see names I recognize. But one question was, 10, 15 years ago, the city was, what, 50,000? How come there seems to be so much more work? I think I know. How come there seems to be so much more work for them now than there was then? Because they're going to full time from being advisory at one time. Mm-hmm. I guess it's because of legal issues that come up that the city has to address all the time.
I mean, I think, you know, any kind of, I think there's a lot more regional work. You know,
more than the city.
And there's a lot more committees. And
there's a lot more expectations.
Yeah.
You know, if we're not at the table.
Right.
Yeah. I asked that question just for information. I'm sort of curious.
Yeah.
But is the city's big enough? The other cities are doing it. I think they should be compensated. Mm-hmm. And I think within this group, I think we've got it here to put that together.
Yeah.
And maybe do a hearing.
Well, the one thing we haven't identified is we need two or three potential volunteers to work with Neil to get at least to frame the questions to bring back to this group. Who would be willing to do that? Anybody else interested in helping with that? Uh-huh. Stacy? Okay.
And then I can just get you, maybe, Brenda, if I do like a memo, we can just do an information packet. So
that'd
with some
good
background and some sample language and that kind of thing, we can pull that together relatively easily.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we put, are you intending for us to review as a group the language of the survey for this subgroup just to kind of make the decisions and go?
I think we ought to review it.
So can we be on the agenda soon, Brenda?
Yeah. Do you think we could put this together?
For the March.
For next
another
2 week
work session.
March 19th, we don't have any work ahead, but we have a public hearing that night.
So we could do a work session follow up on the 19th, and that should give you guys a couple of weeks. That should give enough time. And then if Mary Bridget can pull that information together for us, we'll just have a lot more information. We'll be able to share the potential questions. And give it a little more thought about their outreach process and how we want to accomplish that.
Okay.
So, does that make sense?
Yeah.
It sure does. Yeah.
Okay.
That's good.
Good.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I expected them to put this out about 4 or 5 years ago. So I
asked you to come and
them to do something.
Well, that's why I was so surprised that the mayor here when I first came here wasn't paid.
Okay. All right. We'll adjourn the CCI and we'll call to order the work session of the Planning Commission.
In this case, it's me.
Our first item this evening is establishment of the Willamette River Greenway setback. On some properties in Glenwood. And turn it over to Mark.
I want to introduce Gary Darnell. He is the Springfield, not Lane County, as I put in my cover notice to you, Springfield hearings official.
He does act as hearings official for Lane County. Gary sits in and actually conducts hearings for land use issues that are outside the city limits, but inside Springfield's urban growth boundary. You folks hear issues that are specific to Springfield inside the urban growth boundary. Because of Gary's position as a hearings official, his relationship with staff is different than our relationship. I, as a staff person, can speak to you as my planning commission about the merits of a particular land use issue that may be coming before you and not have a violation of ex parte contact. That does not hold true for a situation with my friend Mr. Darnell as a hearings official. I can't talk to him on the side about the merits of an issue. He needs to hear these things in public hearing and so on. So we're going to talk about the approval criteria and sort of the background of the Willamette Greenway boundary, the Willamette Greenway setback, and the difference between those two things. And on top of that, there are things, Clean Water Act established setbacks from the Willamette River, the natural resources study that you folks reviewed and approved some years ago sets setbacks from the river. And these things kind of pile on one another. And as you receive my staff report, I want to avoid confusion, I guess, and just help you to see the forest for the trees and know what we're talking about. Because the criteria for establishing the setback, the purpose and so on of that setback is different than the reasons for setting, creating a setback for water quality or creating a setback for natural resource protection. And they're different. But the focus for you folks with this application is going to be on the criteria for the setback. These other types of things are out there, but your focus is going to be on the Greenway setback and the criteria for establishing that setback. So just trying to move us along. The Wildish Land Company has submitted a request to establish the Greenway setback line on property and homes in the Glenwood area. The purpose of this work session, I said, is to familiarize you with some of those concepts, help clarify some terminology related to Goal 5 in the Greenway. And again, because the subject properties are mostly inside the city limits, but because there's one tax lot that's outside the city limits, we have Gary's protection. This here, I think there's a way I can actually point.
It won't go because it goes through the TV. Sorry.
That's a powerful laser then, huh?
It is.
It goes right through. Very good.
Sorry.
The subject area is just this area along the river. This is Glenwood. This is the tail of the pork chop, as we call it. This is a close-up, and you can see these lots here, the ones that are generally are part of this application. Tax lot 2800 is the north end, is actually the one that is not within the city limits. The string of tax lots to the south, and there are a couple of small tax lots that I didn't label just because you didn't need to know, but the point is there are multiple tax lots, one of which is outside the city limits, the remainder are inside the city limits, and that's the reason for the joint hearing. Excuse me. As I mentioned, we're not going to be talking about the merits of the application, and so you might be tempted to ask me specifics about this application and whether I think it meets or does not meet criteria, and help me not go there.
Don't make me leave the room.
But again, key issues, key terms, Greenway boundary, Greenway setback, and the difference between those things and the water quality development setback and the Goal 5 development setback that are also part of our rules. Just a little background. I grew up in Oregon. I remember when the Willamette River was really kind of a cesspool. I mean, it was just the place where all the mills and everybody dumped their stuff, and it was a pretty nasty place. In the early to mid-60s, there was concern about that, and there's also concern about the Oregon coast and protecting it. And out of those two concerns came legislation, one to protect the Willamette River and to clean it up, But also, the roots of Oregon's planning laws altogether came out of the Oregon Coast issue, the Lima Greenway issue. And so in 73, there was a formal Lima Greenway Act that was passed. It was tied to what was then called Senate Bill 100, which is the rudiments of our statewide land use planning program. In 1975, DLCD set standards for, well, there was a Greenway goal put into the list of statewide planning goals. Bob Straub, who has roots here in the Springfield area, was part of initiating that Greenway action. The man in the middle there you recognize is Bob Straub. The woman on the right you might not know, that's Maureen Neuberger. She was senator for, I think, one term, and then she filled her husband's term. But she was really instrumental in Washington in getting money for helping to restore Loud River. Goal 15, the Willamette River Greenway goal, requires local governments to establish greenway boundaries, to establish allowed uses within those greenway boundaries, and then to identify potential areas for acquisition. Local jurisdictions, we retain primary responsibility for implementation of the Willamette River Greenway goal. Our metro plan, which is still our metro plan, has a chapter on the greenway. And this is a little excerpt out of it, but one of the policies that, one of the elements of the metro plan includes, like I said, this chapter on the greenway, and the metro plan diagram basically defines, shows on the map where that greenway is. Again, the greenway is this thick green line. This is an excerpt from the metro plan diagram. You can see along the river here through Glenwood, that green line follows very close to the riverfront. You see on the north side, that line is away from the river. It actually follows the boundary of Altenbaker Park, Island Park. It juts out and takes in Doris Ranch, Clearwater Park down here, etc. You can see kind of off the map, but coming back this way, it takes in all of Mount Pisgah and Buford Park. The direction from the state was to establish Willamette Greenway Corridor as a minimum of 150 feet from top of bank on the river, but also to take in public lands adjacent to the river. So there's some guidelines the state gave to the cities, but this is how it shows on our map. So the Greenway area in Glenwood, the Greenway boundary is pretty close to the riverfront. It's part of that 150 foot element. The Greenway through the Eugene Springfield metro area, and this is an excerpt from the metro plan itself, it's a variety of public and private ownership. There are areas along the river in Eugene Springfield that are commercial. You see restaurants, if you think of Valley River Inn, comes right down to the riverfront. Sweetwater's, there's McMiniman's, the old High Banks restaurant. Those are commercial uses that come up and provide visual access to the river. There are also places in Glenwood, which is going to be the subject we talk about, that has industrial uses. You think of Oldham's Crane. That is an industrial use. Mermo and Sons, Steve's operation, those are industrial uses that back up to the river. So when we talk about, and we'll get to this, a greenway setback, it's not a protection from development altogether. Cities are intended to or required to plan for what land uses are going to take place within side the greenway boundary and implement those plans. In some cases, we plan for public use, parks and other those kinds of things. In other cases, we plan for residential use, commercial use, and industrial use.
Factual question, just the facts.
Yes.
The land that's involved here is in the Glenwood plan is light industrial. is that correct?
The Glenwood Refinement Plan shows most of that as light, medium industrial.
Light, medium industrial.
Yeah, there is a small fragment of commercial mixed use in the north, but it's primarily an industrial use.
Okay.
Going from the Metro Plan, which is sort of that general metro-wide philosophy and statement of what we intend to do as a region, we get down to the Springfield Development Code, and what does it say about that Willamette Greenway? And we have, a chapter in our development code that talks about what is the purpose of the greenway, and how do you establish, in particular, what we're going to talk about tonight, the greenway setback line. We have the boundary, which is that 150-foot corridor. Within, between that boundary and the river, we're going to be talking about establishing something called the setback line that's different. The setback line is a development setback. The greenway boundary is simply a frame within which we apply greenway policies.
Okay.
We apply greenway policies through the Willamette Greenway Overlay District. Planning 101, you folks are probably familiar with this idea, but we have zoning. An overlay district is something that sits on top of that zoning and modifies to some degree the tenets of the base zoning district. So if there's a residential zoning district, an overlay on top of that can modify some of the rules and standards that are part of a residential zoning district. That is true of the Willamette Greenway. There is a Willamette Greenway overlay that covers that 150-foot corridor. It also covers the bump outs for public land and so on, and it modifies the underlying zoning. So in the case of Glenwood, where you have a mix of industrial and commercial and residential zoning districts, this Willamette Greenway is an overlay. All the allowed uses within that zoning district are allowed, but they're modified by the overlay district. As we mentioned, the greenway setback line, and this is basically quotations out of our code, is established to protect, maintain, preserve, and enhance the natural, scenic, historic, and recreational qualities of the Willamette Greenway. This verbiage is kind of a cut and paste from the state Goal 15 language. Only water-dependent and water-related uses are permitted between the Willamette River and the greenway setback line. Again, Wildish has come to us with a request to establish a greenway setback line. So the alignment of that greenway setback, once established, that's a development setback, and only water-dependent or water-related uses are allowed between that setback line and the river itself. The state does make one exception, the state recognizes multi-use paths as a water-related, water-dependent use.
So, a quick clarifying question. So that is it really dependent on what their use is, not on the land itself, where that setback line falls?
It's something we'll get into, but it's,
or it's a
combination. To be a balancing act, mm-hmm. so to speak, that as we get into the criteria for where you set that line,
mm-hmm.
Clearly the line is intended to protect riparian vegetation and other things, but where that line is put needs to reflect a balance between economic issues, social issues, recreational access, and other things in addition to just strict environmental protection.
So if a new owner has a change of use, that setback line can be adjusted, or is that setback line once it's set?
You'd have to go through an amendment process to change the setback line, but I think for all intents and purposes we're intending to set that line
mm-hmm.
and hold that line. Regardless of whether the overall land is changed from industrial to mixed-use residential or something else, the,
mm-hmm.
the purpose of establishing that setback line, I don't think you want to go moving it every other year.
Right. Okay.
Standards, and this is what you'll be discussing and determining is really the focus of the staff report. There are several standards related to how do you determine where to put the setback line. And this is, again, information language that comes right out of the Willamette River Greenway goal. First being local, regional, and state recreational needs shall be provided for. The Greenway corridor, part of the purpose for establishing that was to establish a recreational access, recreational purpose. That doesn't mean that all of the corridor is to be recreational. It's not to be one big park. That's one consideration. Adequate public access to the river shall be provided. What is adequate access? Adequate is, I think, a function and part of what is the designation that this community is assigned to land. If you have land that is planned and zoned for commercial use, does that mean that you're going to have as much access from the public to the riverfront as if that wasn't commercial, it was Island Park, you know, a public land and open space? Probably not. There's going to be a difference. But there should be appropriate public access along through that corridor. Significant wildlife, fish and wildlife habitat shall be protected. Identified scenic qualities and viewpoints shall be preserved. Maintenance of public safety and protection of the public, private property, especially from vandalism, trespass, shall be provided for to the maximum extent practicable. That last phrase, maximum extent practicable, is a term that the attorneys love. It's something that you see used in by the EPA in talking about how do you achieve protection of water quality. And the idea is intentionally to allow some flexibility on the kinds of standards and measures that you require of someone who is doing development along a river to achieve the goals of protecting water quality and yet allowing people to develop their property for the pros' use. But in this case, the issue, public safety and protection of private property, in the Willamette River corridor, for Island Park, for example, there has been problems with camping. People, homeless folks and so on, we call Blue Tarp communities, setting up campments along the river because of the broad natural area. They're sort of out of sight, out of mind to a certain extent. And the Greenway corridor, part of the consideration in setting that setback line is you don't want to encourage that kind of situation, whether it's homeless camping, you don't want to encourage trespass. Again, balancing that idea of public access, but not trespass. You know, it's again one of those balancing measures that we're going to be looking at. The natural vegetative fringe along the river shall be enhanced and protected to the maximum extent practicable. That too, again, the goal is protect that green strip along the river. Throughout Glenwood, that green strip is fairly narrow. It's a highly disturbed area. But the goal is to protect what strip is there, and then to basically balance development of that land for whatever the planned use is in conjunction with protecting that strip. Location of known aggregate deposits shall be considered. I think it's well, I can tell you, I think it's a fact that the Wildish site was used back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s for aggregate extraction. It's been reclaimed, has not been used for that for several years, but aggregate resources are one of those things that you consider. I don't think it's an issue here because that has been kind of mined out, tapped out. Development shall be directed away from the river to the greatest degree. Provided, however, lands committed to urban uses shall be permitted to continue as urban uses, including ports, public, industrial, commercial, and residential uses, uses pertaining to navigational requirements, water and land access needs, related facilities. This is how you get, this kind of pictures, I guess, to the best degree what you're going to be considering. This is an urban environment. This is inside of UGB. This Willamette Greenway extends all the length of the Willamette River, and outside of our UGB incorporates rules for agriculture, how you treat the river in agricultural zones and so on. Our focus is urban. So the intent of setting this setback requires us to consider urban uses. How does that setback work within an urban setting? And the examples that are given, public land, industrial land, commercial land, residential land, how do we direct development away from the river and still have these other kinds of development balanced in, for lack of a better term. So it's not as clear as some of our other standards that are more dimensional. You know, you shall be 5 feet back from your property line and so on. There is, through this process, the establishment of a setback line. Our policy says that the Planning Commission, through a discretionary use process, will make those determinations. We will, you know, you will be acting on the applicant's requested setback line. In the staff report, and we have a draft staff report, I'm going to send that out probably late this week, so you have more than just the 4 or 5 days you usually get to look at it. You will see references to past wildlife studies and so on that were done for other reasons besides this application. The applicant has hired a biologist to prepare similar kinds of findings, but those pieces of information will inform you about the viability of the greenway in the vicinity of the Wildish Company land. It will give you some information about the whether or not the setback line is a good line. But again, you're going to get information not just from the applicant's biologist. There have been past studies going back to the 90s more recently. In 2004, there was a study for the Glenwood area that was part of the original Glenwood Riverfront plan. Even as late as December 2013, there was a company hired to do a survey of land on properties basically north of the railroad tracks, north of the railroad trestle in Glenwood. Doesn't affect this property. The report doesn't contain any information about it, but there are properties north of the trestle that where the biologists, professional people, not the applicants, you know, are on the land, on the ground, looking at the riverfront and, you know, the environmental values and the species there and so on. So that will be available for you to look at. Hopefully, it's my job to give you the tools that you need to fairly evaluate the proposed setback. And anyway, we just wanted to give you a little bit of a briefing in advance of getting that. So just in addition to this wild or greenway setback, there are, as I mentioned, overlapping protection measures. These don't affect the location of the setback, but again, when you're talking about environmental protection, there are other kinds of setbacks already in place. The first being under our development code, in response to the Federal Clean Water Act, we adopted a 75-foot setback from top of bank along the Willamette River. That's a development setback. It's different than what the greenway setback will be. Just because there's a 75-foot setback does not mean that you have to put the greenway setback on the 75-foot line. It's a whole different purpose. So I only bring this up not to confuse you, but you may have been aware of these other setbacks before. The greenway setback is different. The purpose is different. Again, the greenway setback reflects a balancing of community access, development, protection of the riparian fringe, protection of scenic values and other things. It's a different purpose than the setback for the Clean Water Act, for example. So again, try to keep you focused on why are we setting the greenway setback? What is the, what are the criteria we'll be using, and so on. So again, the greenway boundary is that broad boundary that just defines the edges of that greenway corridor. The greenway setback line is a development setback line. You set it through this balancing of different objectives, and then the two other setback lines, which are there, but you don't pay attention to, you don't worry about those, but just don't let them confuse you. Any questions?
Questions?
On that map you showed, and you don't have to go back to it, the metro plan map, that green line that was on the map, is that the greenway setback line?
That is the greenway boundary.
Oh, okay.
So that, the unfortunately, the metro plan diagram is at such a scale that the thickness of that line is probably more than 150 feet. Gary, I think, actually measured it one time on another issue we were dealing with. But the point in showing you that is that the line in some places is right against the river, that 150 foot line. There are other places where the boundary wows out to take in land that is public land for the most part. In our case, it takes in Island Park, Doris Ranch, Clearwater Park, but in the Glenwood area, it's pretty much that 150 foot ribbon on the edge of the river.
Good.
From the low water point.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Because then it talks about the top of the bank, which is the 75-foot setback that we're used to with the development setback.
Okay. Yes.
Now, I know one term in there was a reference to public access to the river. Now, I'm presuming that's a flexible term because there are certain points along the river where you'd really want to discourage public access because the river is dangerous because of steep bank or a rapid current. So it isn't necessarily an invitation for public access in all parts of the...
No, it's not. And again, if you read statewide Goal 15 and the language that's in the Oregon Administrative Rules, you'll see that the greenway boundary is not intended to create public use of private land. It does want to create opportunities for access, you know, to the river. In the Eugene's, in the metro plan diagram, let me back up. In the transplant, which is kind of a subset of the metro plan, there shows a bike path along the riverfront through Glenwood. The same bike path is shown on Willamette Lane's master plan for future development. That kind of feature would provide public access, but it doesn't mean that there's going to be a, you know, a huge park. It's not like having Island Park all the way through the corridor. There are going to be places
linear
where
park,
right? There are going to be places where there's just a 20-foot right of way with a multi-use path. That's what's intended with the Willamette Lane, but it's not a park, so it's different. But that gives some public access to the river, and again, the greenway intends for water-related, water-dependent uses to be approved within that setback. And in this case, what our community is planning for in the future is this multi-use path along the riverfront in Glenwood.
Okay. One more.
The Glenwood Refinement Plan dealt with these setbacks to some extent, and my memory doesn't serve as there was one of the setbacks that was established through the Glenwood Refinement Plan. Was that the setback line, or which one of those boundary lines were, because it was concurrently supposed to automatically establish?
You know, because of the appeal of the more recent Glenwood Riverfront Plan, what you found in that plan, what was approved, is sort of in abeyance. What is on the table and enforced now is the Glenwood Refinement Plan that was adopted in 1999. That still talks about that in conjunction with the metro plan, talks about a Willamette Greenway corridor the Willamette Greenway boundary and the necessity of setting a setback line. So we are going through this process of setting. There's no automatic setback, no automatic placement of the greenway setback. It's something that will be determined. Basically, you will be considering the applicant's request for what they're proposing, and we'll consider that through this process.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
We have a public hearing, quasi judicial, on this on March 19th. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Correct. Next meeting.
Yes, I'm sorry. March 19th is when you're going to be seeing this.
Yeah.
Will we be meeting on a session before then, or we're just going to jump from your notes to us to
we're
the hearing?
We're going to go to public hearing.
Okay.
I will have a staff report. It will not be as lengthy, but we will go through specific findings that I think will be helpful to you. I will not read you my entire report,
you
will have my entire report.
Okay.
Now Gary's gone, we can
and
talk.
He couldn't discuss the findings or
no, and
you know,
I don't
those
plan
types
to
of
now.
Things.
We're finished with this item,
yeah.
I think.
So
but you're
okay.
Not done with me yet.
That's right. So let's talk about a cell tower application, shall we?
Do we have a picture?
Well, I need to figure out how to finish this presentation.
Do you want me to do it, Mara?
Pardon? Yes.
And how are your triplets?
Healthy and getting bigger. They were born 3 pounds to 4 pounds. They're all now over 9 pounds.
Wow.
Healthy. And mom and dad are figuring it out. It isn't pretty.
Oh,
but
that's
how could
that
be? You can imagine, as a business owner yourself, how hard it is to run a business that you own and operate,
yeah.
And then find time for family and other things, and
yeah.
They've struggled with that, but it's working out. Thank you.
Are they identical or not?
Two are identical, and then there's a third fraternal.
Oh, interesting.
So,
yeah.
And the two that are identical, the only way that my wife can figure, there's a little, like a little freckle thing on one of them here.
Oh, wow.
that's
really special.
I can imagine Kay with those babies.
She's excited. She spent the first full month with my daughter and son-in-law trying to help them cope.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of got their feet under them, and it's working out. Okay.
Schedule and routine.
Yeah, it is. It really is. But,
from a quiet household to a chaotic household.
She was brave enough to bring the triplets down to visit our office last Friday. And unfortunately, we missed Brenda. But anyway, let's get on with this.
Yes.
Springfield has received an application from what was AT&T. It's now New Singular Wireless PCS LLC. But anyway, we'll just call it AT&T for them. This will be the first time we've had a tower application come through under our new standards.
That's right.
Yeah.
Council, as you know, it's been almost 2 years ago now, asked the staff to come back to them with a new way of doing processing cell tower applications. In the past, cell towers that were proposed for land zoned primarily industrial or public land and open space could be approved by staff without public notice.
Yeah.
And that created a little issue, I think. And so the new plan basically has this planning commission, this body reviewing all tower facilities. When I say tower facilities, the new policies classify cellular facilities as stealth, which are facilities that are totally invisible. There are different kinds of equipment that are behind parapets on the top of roofs. There are even internal to buildings and other things that are wireless systems that can transmit cell, so on, but you can't see them, even if you're across the fence next door. That's a stealth. Low visibility are those things that, for example, there's some pictures I'll show you here.
Palm trees?
High visibility, yeah, low visibility. Can you see the,
the
light
on the
fixture?
Light,
the little antenna on the light fixture.
Yeah.
If you go out Main Street, when you get to, I think it's 68th where the Dairy Mart is, there is a telephone pole that has these two funny little aerials on top of the telephone pole. That is another kind of cell facility. Moderate visibility facilities are ones that you review as Planning Commission, the same with high visibility. Those things come to you for review. And we're going to talk about the standards that you'll be looking at and reviewing tonight. But what is being proposed is a faux pine tree, similar to the one shown in the middle there. That is a moderate facility, a moderate visibility facility. Approval criteria, just basically number two, moderate and high visibility facilities are going to be processed by you folks. What are the standards you're going to be looking at? All towers are going to be designed for co-location. That means that while AT&T is building this tower, they have to design it so that T-Mobile can come along later and add antenna array. So competitors have to be able to co-locate on those towers. There has to be a demonstrated need for this facility. They have to show there's a coverage gap.
I got a question.
Yeah.
If AT&T puts up that tower, somebody comes along and wants to locate on it, AT&T owns it, can they deny them use of it?
They have signed an agreement that says they will allow competitors to locate.
Right, because I can suddenly see if they denied them, then suddenly somebody else would want to put one up over here, and that's not what we're trying to
do. No, and that's the reason for this code.
Yeah,
we actually asked them to prove that they cannot co-locate someplace else and cover the gap.
All right.
And they have provided evidence to that effect. I'll show you some of the mapping stuff that they've done. So they have to demonstrate that there's a need. They have to demonstrate where is that coverage, where is that lack of service. This here area that is not highlighted in light green represents where there is a gap in coverage for 4G services. Now, does that mean there's a total lack of service? No, it just means that there's not good service.
That's,
you know, if you
different
get your phone
than
out,
3G,
it might be
right?
Two.
You know what 4G means?
Oh, yeah.
Fourth generation.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't. I didn't know.
Some of us
time.
Are still 3G.
Mm-hmm.
All this to say, this is information provided by their engineering folks that show where their coverage gap is. And then we ask them, okay, given that coverage gap, what if you co-located at some of these existing towers that are in the area? Would it cover that gap? And so in this case, locating here would cover some but not all of the gap. And we made them do that for each of the towers in the area to show, you know, what would happen. The other thing is we asked them to prove that they need a tall tower versus something shorter. What they've asked for is a 120-foot tower, which is typical in Springfield. There are towers.
It's an awfully tall pine tree, let me tell you.
You have to use fir.
Faux fir.
Well, fir trees actually get to be 300 feet, but
yeah,
anyway, all this to say, we asked them to show that you can't make the coverage by using a shorter facility. And in this case, there's a 70-foot. This is what they would predict coverage to be with a 70-foot, and there's some gaps still in that.
I have a question, and it's kind of off the subject a little bit, but what property is this looking at? Does who owns that property?
You know, it's not off. I just skipped right over that, and I shouldn't have. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
This is proposed for the Court Sports Facility on Pheasant Boulevard in the Gateway area. This is located north of Les Schwab Tires, if you can picture Les Schwab Tires on Harlow Road.
Okay.
At the corner of Pheasant and Harlow Road is a crossroads economy studio
it's
suites.
It's like a motel.
It's like there's a motel right
yeah.
beside it.
Okay.
A weekly rental motel.
Yeah, weekly.
The court sports facility is immediately north of those two facilities. It runs from Pheasant all the way over to a boundary with the Point condominium. There's a little residential area west of court sports that is apartment complexes, duplex development, and then this condominium called The Point.
Yeah. Who pays the taxes on it then? Is it kind of like a billboard tax type thing, or?
There is a franchise tax, but I don't pretend to know how it
works. I was just curious if
usually they pay
kind of
rent,
financial
yeah. rent then to court sports is usually how it's
Oh, I'm sorry,
done.
Yes.
So court sports.
Court sports.
Oh, the site.
Right.
Site
so they'll
rent,
rent that portion
sure.
of it and probably, okay, so there is
yeah.
some, a little bit of a financial.
Yeah.
There is a benefit
from
to court sports,
doing this.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that said, if there are other providers that co-locate on the tower,
right.
they will pay AT&T a fee for renting space on their tower. So they're required to show the need for coverage. They're required to show, you know, why can't you just co-locate? Why can't you build a shorter tower? And this is evidence they provided.
Is this the 70-foot? Tower
this here is a 70
yes.
foot. You can see there's still some gaps here and down here.
And this is the 120.
And this
and then
is
that's the 150.
With their 120.
120.
So, again, their goal is to, and they're required to show us that where's the gap? Why can't you meet that gap by co-locating? Why can't you meet that gap by having something shorter than a 120 foot tower?
One thing I noticed on the 70-foot tower, you got limited access in Gateway Mall.
Yeah. Yeah. There are still areas with this tower that are not covered.
Yeah.
It doesn't pretend to take care of all the coverage
yeah.
issues, but you can, if you remember the first slide, it does.
Why would that be an island of non-coverage in the middle of coverage? Is there another tower that serves the other side of I-5?
You know, I couldn't tell you because this is specific to AT&T.
Yeah.
Now, they may need to locate someplace over here in Eugene
right.
to cover that. Huh. But with the towers that are available where they have facilities, that even with this new tower is not going to cover that area. They need to make a good faith effort of trying to identify less intrusive alternatives, including but not limited to less sensitive sites, alternative design systems, alternative tower designs, use of repeaters and other things. They asked staff, you know, what might be the best way to conceal or make this tower less visible. They originally talked about locating on city land immediately to the east of Court Sports across Pheasant Boulevard is station number 5,
right.
Firehouse. It's the newest fire station. My recommendation to them was no, don't go there because in the immediate vicinity of the firehouse are single family homes, neighborhoods. The zoning there is LTR. The zoning on Court Sports is commercial. The zoning to the south is commercial. The zoning to the west is multifamily. To the north is commercial. North of Court Sports is a large, it's secure storage,
mm-hmm.
Springfield secure storage, mini storage. So they were looking around, they contacted Crossroads to see about, you know, what is the viability of locating on a rooftop and not creating a tower. You remember the 70-foot height?
Mm-hmm.
Crossroads, I think, is 3 stories. That gets you up about 50, 55 feet. And so it wasn't tall enough to achieve their coverage goals. So they went through that regimen of trying to locate other alternatives to putting up a tower.
Could
one is cheaper for them. There's less, you know, political pushback. If they could have identified someplace where they can put antenna on a roof, staff could deal with that and you wouldn't have to be doing it. But this is...
Now, Mark, the reality is FCC, there's federal regulation that says that they have a right to be able to provide this service. Is that?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But it's true. the federal law says that cities have the ability to create land use standards to modify how these things affect their neighborhoods. But the bottom line is those local rules cannot have the effect of denying competition between providers, and it cannot, you know, intentionally or unintentionally deny service. So there are some limits to the hoops that we can make companies jump through.
Right.
And I think it's in our interest to have a city that's, you know, fully served.
Sure.
The downside is, like with those telephone poles and the wires that were part of our neighborhoods in years past, those are utility facilities that we have to function, but they're ugly.
Yeah.
Now, we've learned to find ways to put them underground and this and that, but I can tell you I've got this 5 foot wide, 4 foot tall box in my front yard, which is a transformer. And, you know, that serves everybody in my neighborhood. But, yeah, you know, I just plant flowers around it.
Happens to be on your lawn.
It happens to be on my lawn. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Tim?
Following up to Steve's original question about having an agreement to co-locate, is there some kind of stipulations that speaks to possible electronic interference between multiple providers? Because I could see where a new installation or a new installation from a new provider could interfere with the functioning of an original provider's equipment.
I don't think there is a problem when you're locating on the same tower because providers have different frequencies they're assigned. So AT&T tower with AT&T equipment on it is going to broadcast at a certain frequency. T-Mobile is going to be broadcasting at a different frequency on that same tower. So those two antenna array are not going to interfere with one another there. You can get, and what I'm told is you can have interference if AT&T has a tower too close to one of its own towers. And you're broadcasting
drop
on the...
Yeah, mm-hmm. It won't know where to
So I don't pretend to know for certain, but one of the rationales you'll see on... well, it was actually on some of those maps I was showing, the little notations from their engineer. This is too close. And it's not just because they're going to be overlapping existing coverage. They're too close because it creates some interference.
Because one of the things I could see is that since you have companies that are competitors of having somebody intentionally interfere with someone else's equipment, so just for competitive reasons, overriding somebody else's signal.
I don't know if that's a problem or not, but my understanding is that because they're assigned different frequencies, they're not going to hurt each other.
And the FCC regulates those
yeah.
frequencies, and they sell those frequencies. I mean, they
so
sell rights to those
it's
frequencies.
Like everybody has their own lane on the freeway.
Yeah.
But all this to say, that's not our issue.
Exactly.
We're trying to minimize community impact for what is really a needed utility.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not something you probably want in your front yard. And so we've tried in the past through our mechanisms to encourage development of these or industrial areas.
I think a palm tree would look better than a...
Well, okay. That's part of your discretionary...
Yeah, but there goes the stealth part of it. We don't have palm trees.
There goes the neighborhood.
Oh, we do. I've seen a few around.
Well, yeah, but I mean...
Not that
we do have in our code some limitations about where you can put towers. It happens that in the zoning districts listed to the left, there are certain types that are of... facilities allowed. The particular zoning here is community commercial. The proposed type is a moderate visibility, and that's allowed under our code. There are a number of factors that will not be applicable. Here's one. For example, you can only have one high visibility facility on one lot. Well, they're only proposing one tower, and there's no tower there. There has to be a separation of 2,000 feet between towers. There is more than 2,000 feet separation between towers in the area. Facilities adjacent to residentially zoned property, they have to be set back from the property line such that the tower falls down. You're not going to smash somebody's house. The tower is set back more than 120 feet from residential property line. Historic buildings and structures. This is not in a historic district. There are no historic facilities or buildings that would be impacted by this. Equipment location. The towers are not supposed to be in front of the building and the side yard and other kinds of things. Court sports as a complex sits back away from the street. This particular rule was enacted in part because of the tower that's on Olympic, that's right out on the street. There's another tower similar on Centennial near the Moose Lodge. It's just right out there. So we've established that towers can't be right out on the street. There has to be setback. That's not an issue here. There are some limits on tower heights. If the tower height exceeds the height limit for the zone, it has to come to this body, which it has to come to you anyway. Accessory building size. With each tower, which you don't notice because you're looking at the tower, is at the base, there's an equipment building.
Yeah.
And it's not supposed to be higher than 12 feet tall, more than 30 feet long, etc. And so in this case, the accessory building, which contains backup generator in case the power goes out, it contains a lot of the electronics and so on that operate the system and so on. It contains air conditioners that create noise. Those are all contained in this building. Visual impact, again, the placement. You're supposed to use vegetated screening, methods of camouflage and other kind of things to minimize the appearance of the equipment building, but also do what you can to minimize the visibility of the tower facility. This is what is being proposed, this faux pine approach. Instead of having an aluminum Christmas tree, it has to be a green tree, something that is painted to not be highly reflective. Should use colors and textures that blend into the background, that kind of thing. Camouflage facilities, which is what we're talking about.
There aren't a lot of big trees.
No,
right,
and that's an issue. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for them to meet this particular standard in that says, you know, whatever facility is not going to stand out. Well, there's nothing 120 feet tall in that whole area. But I think, frankly, it's a reasonable effort to try and minimize the visibility. As part of their showing us what is the likely impact, we require something called photo simulations. So there are six or eight different images like this one that show from different distances, different directions, what is the likely impact. This happens to be on Pheasant Boulevard, looking in the driveway at
this
Court
is like
Sports.
The firehouse across Pheasant Boulevard.
You're if you were turning from Pheasant into the entrance at Court Sports, this is what it would look like.
It could be a better looking tree.
Yeah, can
it?
They bring the branches down some, make it a little wider?
Yeah, they really trim those branches.
Yeah.
Well, you always laugh, Christmas, but you know, there may be some ability to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the long run, it's going to stick out. It just, is this better than having a traditional monopole?
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Is that a reasonable?
Is it completely up to the provider to ensure that an installation like this is not susceptible to windstorms and weather?
It's an engineering factor. That is something where our building and safety people will look at the structural engineering of it to make sure that it's not going to fall down. At the planning level, we're looking at more community impacts.
Right.
This is the appearance from the Point condominium.
I can see it on the other side.
It happens that the condominiums who most directly line up with that tower across the property line, and this is about 140 feet from the tower. It's the ends of the condominium buildings, and there's no windows in there that show. There's also a complex of garages between the condominiums and the property line. That said, there are some condominium units further south towards Les Schwab that do look out onto Les Schwab, and they could see this from their windows. But in terms of what's immediately across from the tower, it's the ends of some buildings that don't have windows. But
that is ugly.
You know, I was just thinking, I don't know whether anybody else, but that actually looks worse than a regular cell tower.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Well, it is part of your purview, I mean, to make a decision as a planning commission that having a traditional monopole would be preferable to having a camouflage.
Can we ask them to make it a little bit of a better camouflage?
Or there are other options in the sense that, for example, flagpoles. They make towers that are supposed to look like flagpoles. Mm-hmm. My personal aesthetic, you know, personal opinion is when I've seen these in pictures, they look like a really fat flagpole. And then you, to have a, proportionally, you have to have like this 40-foot flag, like the one that's out on Main Street, to make it look right. Mm-hmm. Some of you might be familiar with the church in Salem on I-5. If you're going south, there's a church on the hill just as you're leaving Salem. There's a big cross, if you notice, has cell units on it. So they build crosses, they put them in church steeples and other kinds of things. But the faux pine or the faux palm are some of the more common ways of trying to disguise or camouflage a unit in an urban setting. It's just, like you, I go back and forth. I think from a distance, this is probably more attractive than, you know, a traditional monopole. When you get up close, it's easy to see that that's a monopole cell tower, and it's almost an insult that they're doing this to hide it.
But I've seen ones that look a lot better, so I'm not sure if that's just the drawing or if that's truly what they're proposing.
No, this is truly what's being proposed. Mm-hmm. This is what they're required to do, is submit to us visual images. If there are other types, then we can ask them about that. What other options are there? And I can forward that request between now and the meeting on the 19th, which is when you'll hear this.
I think, I mean, this is just me speaking, but I mean, that is, that I've seen a lot of cell tower poles, and that's got to be one of the ugliest ones I have seen.
Well, yeah, so it's what the alternatives are. And again, one option is to tell them, no, don't make this a camouflage tree.
But the other option would be, what other camouflage tree options are out there and available?
Right.
I mean, there are probably five different manufacturers of these things. And they probably have some contract with this particular manufacturer that saves them money, and so this is what they are proposing. Yeah. But
that'll be part of your deliberations, is have they done enough to try and camouflage or minimize the visual impact? And again, one of the choices is, you know, it just looks better as a monopole. You know,
can't we go back and say, do we need to do that in the hearing, or can you do that on our behalf now, is to ask them to provide other options?
I plan to contact the representative and saying that in work session there were some problems with this particular, you know, pine tree. Are there alternative trees, other ways to camouflage that you'd be prepared to do?
You're so diplomatic, Mark.
Well, I think that's what you're hearing.
We want them to be successful in the sense that our community needs to be wired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the other hand, it's our responsibility around this table to minimize the impact of people who live around here.
Exactly.
And so there's not much you can do with a 120-foot metal tower, but this is their effort. It's a common one.
That's good.
So.
Okay.
These two, it's not a facade-mounted antenna, so this doesn't apply. It's not a roof-mounted antenna, this doesn't apply. I showed you a couple of the photo simulations. They also included a noise study by an accredited engineer. The noise from the air conditioning units that keep all the electronics cool, when you're at the property line with the point, the amount of noise generated would be about that. That would be a conversation level between two people standing 1 meter apart. That's the level of decibel that, you know, this would emit. So it's not a loud kind of thing, even in the middle of the night, if you sleep with your windows open, it should not be a problem.
Okay.
Signage, there will be no signs on this other than the warning, you know, you're gonna get electrocuted if you climb this tower kind of thing. But I think apparently the experience has been in other cities that people wanna take this tower and turn it into some kind of advertising. You know, eat at Joe's, so they're not allowed to do that. Traffic obstruction, you can't put a tower in a place that's gonna obstruct traffic. In this particular case, they're proposing to put it almost adjacent to the existing court sports site. It takes up 3 parking spaces and does not interfere with sidewalks or drive lanes through the facility. Parking, court sports already has more than the minimum required parking, so losing the 3 spots does not cause a problem. This is the layout. This is Pheasant Boulevard. There's a field of parking here and along here. This here down in the corner is where the tower will be, and the equipment room is here. This is a little landscape bulb out, and it's a similar bulb out down here that they're gonna place the tower. So it really doesn't interfere with the function of the facility. Down here is Les Schwab and the Crossroads facility. The Point condominium is here, but starting at about here and up is a subdivision of duplexes. Just a close up, the tree and the equipment shelter. Sidewalks and pathways shall not be blocked. It does not. Lighting. This particular tower is not tall enough to require FAA strobe lighting, so you're not going to have this blinking in the window kind of thing for people. Landscaping. The base around the tower is required to be landscaped, and they have a landscape plan that meets this. Prohibited facilities. It's not in a historic district. It's not in a public right-of-way that limits access. It's not taller than 150 feet, it's 120 feet. And this is not a tower being built for speculation. It's not like we're gonna throw up the tower and hope someone comes and rents space on it. So those are the standards that we consider. So I will, that's the end of the presentation. I will communicate with the company and ask their representative on the 19th with some other ideas. If I can get some pictures in advance, yeah. Maybe I can send them to you before the meeting.
That would be good. Yes, Tim?
I'm just wondering, looking at the mindset of the provider, whether if they intentionally create a simulation that's ugly, that they're going to say, okay, they don't like this, let's go back to a regular pole, probably for cost savings as well, whether that was the intent of having a visualization that looks ugly. Because a regular monopine would look a lot better than that, I would think.
Yeah. It's hard to say.
Yeah. I guess I don't read that kind of intention. Yeah. What they're trying to do is to get a tower.
Yeah.
And they understand that we require them to camouflage. We're the one that require the photo simulation.
Probably cost is their biggest driving factor, so the cost of
They probably have a huge contract, and they put these things up all over, and they have one provider that cuts them a sweet deal, and that's it.
Well, part of this
is simulation
context.
Is the problem. Yeah,
part of this is context. That in East Springfield, at the Springfield Cemetery, there is a monopole that's not camouflaged. It stands in front of a forested area.
Yeah.
It's painted dark brown.
Yeah,
you can't see it from Main Street. I mean, you have to really look for it to see it. So here's something standing
right in the center
in plain sight, but just the color and the background. In this case, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know what do you do with this tower? And I'm sure that they would be responsive to, if you want a flag, they'll give you a flag. But it's hard, and without other trees, other things that would keep it from standing out to look anything other than.
Okay, well, I mean, I think you have our
basic
opinion.
Okay, any other questions? Thanks, Mark.
All right.
We're adjourned.